Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Dionandia podcast. I'm Dr. Rewat Dionandan, global health epidemiologist, and today is episode 14 of our special series of podcasts produced by my undergraduate students in my fourth year international health theory class. Today's episode is brought to us by Kyle Allen Curtis and Stefan Litvinenko, and they've chosen to look at an interesting paper titled Parasite Prevalence and the Worldwide Distribution of Cognitive Ability. If you'd like a link to this paper, come to the website at dionandan.com, click on podcast, and scroll down to the episode titled Parasites and Cognitive Ability. And if you want to leave a message for the podcasters, you can tweet me directly at dionandan, that's D-E-O-N-A-N-D-A-N, or leave a message in the comment section of the website. Now, here are Stefan and Kyle.
Hello, everyone. Huge international health topic today. The effect of infectious disease on intelligence. Now, we base this topic off a really fantastic piece of literature by Christopher Epic and company, in which they looked at the effect of parasitic infection on cognitive ability. They predicted that higher prevalence of infectious disease would lead to lower average national intelligence. Underlying this was the parasite stress hypothesis. Here today to help us further understand this global issue is international health undergraduate student Kyle Anderson. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get down to business. How exactly did these scholars perform their research?
Well, as you said, they started with a prediction. They then used previous data sets on worldwide intelligence and previous data on infectious disease that had used the daily as measured. In the spirit of being thorough and holistic, they did a comparison of the effect of infectious disease with the effect of several other factors, including nutrition, education, proximity to Africa, temperature, and GDP, among others, to see what the major predictors of low IQ were. What they found was that infectious disease had the biggest correlation with low IQ of all the factors analyzed, which, as we know, is what they predicted. The only other significant predictors were high temperature and low GDP. They also wanted to see in which regions this was most prevalent and found that it was in Africa and the insular Pacific. But surprisingly, they didn't find this correlation in South America.
So there are several areas I'd like to address, but let's start at the beginning or at the end, depending on how you look at it. With respect to the data proving this correlation, does their prediction and eventual findings seem all that plausible to you?
Well, it isn't all that perplexing to me, to be honest. There's all sorts of literature on the effect of infectious disease on brain development and its underlying outcome of poor intelligence. And as you said, these men were actually able to find a negative correlation between the two. What's most interesting about their take is the fact that they did not center on the obvious neurotoxic effect of some infectious diseases. In fact, an abundance of literature exists with information about the neurological effects of meningitis, malaria, among others, on brain development and its resulting decrease in IQ, according to a Dr. Olness. It seems it would have been easier to do this, I would think. Instead, they concentrated their analysis on the diversion of energy that a parasite infection causes. And this, in fact, is the foundation of the parasite stress hypothesis that you mentioned earlier.
Right. Can you go into the mechanism of how an infection would affect a metabolic budget? And also, how does the study's hypothesis share relation to this scenario?
Basically explains how the problem was caused. In essence, the foundation of this hypothesis is that the brain is the most energy-demanding part of the body. As they put it, when the body's under parasitic attack, energy will be diverted from the brain to more urgent matters, such as the immune system, or to damaged parts of the brain, of the body, whether to replace irretrievable nutrients, damaged tissue, or the energy is taken by the disease itself, whether it be virus or bacterial, so that it can duplicate. And according to these men and their findings, in areas where IQ is widely recognized to be low, such as Africa, for example, it would be conceivable to explain this low intelligence by the high prevalence of infectious disease, especially when people are affected during important times of brain development.
Do you see any problems with their analysis with the study? Mainly, I didn't like the fact that the results only found correlation. I find that it's a very basic result in my opinion.
Indeed.
I'd like to think a lot of different things can be correlated. However, it doesn't mean that one necessarily causes the other, because at the end of the day, what we really want as researchers is to find causation, correct?
Of course. I completely agree with you. I also felt that the use of some of their factors was misleading. For example, I had a particular problem with their use of the predictor proximity to Africa. My reasoning is twofold. First off, they openly criticized this predictor at the beginning of the paper, and yet they still used it, while other factors from the literature that they criticized were excluded. It's slightly hypocritical, I find. Secondly, this predictor is confounded by redundancy. Many of the other variables, such as poor education, low GDP, high temperatures, poor nutrition, are highly present in Africa. Therefore, it comes as no surprise that proximity to Africa was found to be correlated with low IQ.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier the use of daily as a measure of infectious disease. In your opinion, was this the appropriate tool to quantify infectious disease? And also, to our listeners out there who aren't familiar with the term, what does daily entail exactly?
Well, essentially, daily is the number of years lost to disability. It's a wonderful number that allows us to view the effect of disease in an entirely different and phenomenological manner. It allows us to examine issues that surround the living and not the dead. Existing data sets of daily were already present in the study. Therefore, it alleviated the amount of research the authors needed to do to start up this study. Also, it's the best measure of years lost to disease out there right now. However, their use of daily skewed some data, especially a lack of the parasite to low IQ relationship in South America. The truth of the matter is that infectious disease is still very present in South America, but daily only takes into account 28 human diseases. This measure may not take into account local parasites in South America, which, if appropriately quantified, would notably raise the prevalence of infectious disease in this area.
That's a good point, yes.
And, of course, worldwide prevalence of this health problem is important to examine, but I found that in this particular study, they didn't really have a target population. They concentrated on everyone, really, and by doing this, they started to generalize, I find, forgetting to concentrate on those that are most vulnerable, which I feel is the most important part of the study, concentrating on those most affected. And in this case, I would believe that children are the most affected by this problem, and definitely would have been an interesting addition to this piece.
Well, I'd like to stop you there because, to their credit, they do mention in the study at what age you are most vulnerable to the parasite stress effect. There is a notable decline from infancy to old age in the energetic demands of the brain, and as they put it, quoted from the article, 87% of the body's metabolic budget is reserved to brain development in infancy, but this drops to a booming 44% by age 5, and this measure keeps decreasing to an overall low of 23% in adult males and 27% in females.
Very good point, that's very true, and we definitely have to keep that in mind. But the problem is that they didn't elaborate on this. They just mentioned it in the introduction, and they didn't elaborate on it at all in the rest of the study. And I find that extremely disappointing. No matter what angle you look at, children can be affected. It starts even before this child is born. The prenatal environment is crucial when it comes to preventing infectious disease or loss of IQ in general. During the first 8 weeks of pregnancy, for example, major development is occurring in the fetus. Maternal actions, therefore, have direct effects on the children. In one study in particular by Dr. Weitzman, there was evidence that smoking in pregnant women was associated with neurotoxic effects in their future children and possibly lower IQ.
Yes, also I feel like infectious disease and nutrition show an important relationship. As Dr. Epic put it, individuals who are suffering from nutritional deficiencies, may be less able to mount an effective immune response. What do you think about that?
That's very, very true. After birth, you definitely have to look at the children's nutrition. Are they having enough food? Malnutrition, according to Dr. Ivanovic, I believe, during the first few years of life, is shown to lead to variants of IQ from the norm due to developmental delay. Specifically, have these children been breastfed? breastfeeding, according to a Dr. Gomez Sanchez, for longer than 4 months has well-known positive effects on cognitive development. In addition, we have to look at whether they're eating fish or not, because according to a Dr. Hibelm, the omega-3 fatty acids in this have been proven to have huge benefits on neurological development. And I've been concentrating on children to prove a point, but nutritional deficiencies affect people of all ages. Even though in the study, it was shown to have no significant correlation with low IQ, even the authors acknowledge it would be short-sighted of us to ignore the effects of nutrition entirely.
That's definitely something we need to keep in mind, and to be honest, I feel like this ultimately comes down to being educated, whether it's at the individual, family, community, or even societal level, wouldn't you think?
Definitely. Education ties into all of this. It directly influences knowledge attainment and health literacy, therefore knowing which factors can affect your intelligence and the intelligence of those you care for.
Right, and you raise a good point there. According to one of the works cited, while it is plausible that formal education increases intelligence, it is not possible to determine from the data whether the correlation between education and intelligence is owing to education increasing intelligence, or whether, in general, more intelligent individuals seek more education. That's something to keep in mind.
Indeed.
It's great that you brought up underlying predictors in nutrition and education. I noticed the authors made an effort to be extremely thorough in their analysis, and I'd like to say they took a very interdisciplinary outlook on the problem, even though they were only trying to find a correlation between two items. Some of the variables they incorporated include nutrition, GDP, proximity to Africa, temperature, education, and others amongst items that might affect this problem.
Of course, and that was definitely good of them, but I feel like they definitely missed several important points. To be fair, we need to understand that the authors needed to draw the line somewhere, and they're probably not able to incorporate these issues into the particular study, but I feel like it would have added something to it. And so, where are the social factors in this, besides GDP? Do different workplace environments and social support groups have an effect on this? Does exposure to violence and resulting mental health issues play a part here? The literature, at least the literature I've seen, for the most part, says yes to these questions. Long shifts at work could definitely have a negative effect on cognitive function in middle age, according to a Dr. Virtanen. Peer and parental support both have huge effects on learning and increasing intelligence, according to a Dr. Gonzalez. But to be fair, for these 2 points at least, in some regions, people are too busy working or staying alive to be able to concentrate on learning, studying, or the sort. It would be extremely close-minded of us to expect these individuals to worry about these kinds of things. Lastly, exposure to violence in children and in adults can lead to many mental health issues, including PTSD. Symptoms of this mental health problem and exposure to violence in general were shown to be extremely detrimental to IQ levels, at least according to a Dr. Saltzman.
Right, but like you said, they needed to draw the line somewhere, correct?
Of course. I believe that their use of GDP and temperature was extremely, extremely good, because incorporating these factors into their analysis allowed them to tackle this issue from both a political, environmental, as well as a biological level.
Very well said. Now, a central premise to the study is the Flynn effect. Taken from the original 1989 work, Flynn demands that any hypothesis regarding the worldwide variation and distribution of intelligence must be able to account for some factor that allows for large IQ gains over time spans seemingly too short to be attributed to evolution by natural selection.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you, how exactly do the authors account for the Flynn effect? In essence, I'd like to know the underlying mechanism to account for decreased parasite prevalence and subsequently increases in national IQ.
Well, I won't pretend to be an expert of any sort for this particular hypothesis, but I believe that the answer would be development. As they state in the article, as societies become modernized, decreased parasite stress may occur through multiple pathways. With an increase in national wealth, medicine, vaccinations, and potable water can be purchased by both the government and by individuals. Moreover, cross-national evidence suggests as democratization increases, there are corresponding increases in public health legislation and infrastructure. Democratization also increases levels of education, better allowing individuals to seek out and understand information that reduces parasitic infection.
All right, so the takeaway message I'm getting from this is modernization and development.
Definitely.
These concepts I'd like to think sound great in theory, but if we were to be rational as scientists, where do we stand currently in terms of global development? Worth mentioning are the BRIC nations, BRIC standing for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. These countries, on top of being some of the most populous nations in the world, are especially known for having the world's fastest developing economies. According to The Economist, from 1999 to 2007, China's growth rate was 10.5% a year, whereas India's was 6.5%. To put this into perspective, growth rate in the United States was half of India's during this time. Is this to say that the BRIC nations are subject to reduced infectious disease and higher national IQ in the future?
Unfortunately, the answer to that question is not so straightforward. It's definitely a complicated soup. All in all, development is a positive attribute. However, there is a significant difference between developed and developing. While these BRIC nations may have made tremendous progress in a short period of time, it's important to analyze the quality of the reforms. An example of this would be distribution of modernization. Is it uniform within a country? Are there large health, economic, and political disparities between given members of the same population? Is there a distinction between urban and rural quality of life within a country? Both India and China are phenomenal examples of how two completely polar socioeconomic statuses can be present in one environment. Imagine owning an expensive estate to yourself, yet around the corner of you is an entire impoverished community who share the same communal spaces as you or have the same infrastructure, such as water and sewage treatment. The incredible population dynamics of these countries make it very difficult to apply uniform health mandates.
You raise an excellent point there on discrepancies between urban and rural setting, or even within the same settings themselves. I can vouch for this personally. I remember in the past being on business visits to cities such as Shanghai or Beijing, all in China, and the concept of being amongst Lamborghinis, Ferraris, skyscrapers, and all this incredible wealth in one moment, and driving along slum housing made of mud and dirt the next was just mind-blowing. I was speechless. I can't describe it to you. All this within 15 minutes of travel by car just demonstrates the complexity of achieving robust and widespread national development.
You're right. And while BRIC nations may be headed in the right direction, the concept of shifting from a developing to developed status would not facilitate increases in national IQ, expedited as quickly as a Flynn effect might suggest. With this in mind, to achieve optimal functionality as a society, long-standing and equitable societal infrastructure must be in place. This includes income equality, uniform access to educational opportunities, sustainable health policies and programs, etc. If we look at Scandinavian countries, these are exemplary in distributive reforms, which yield narrow gaps between high and low income earners. Usually leaders in global health across all fronts, these highly balanced social structures mitigate the burden of infectious disease affected from early neurological development throughout the entire lifespan.
Very interesting. So I'd like to think our leaders in global health have a very complex issue to deal with.
Definitely.
When it comes down to mitigating the effects of infectious disease, we need to consider which forms of intervention will be effective and who will take responsibility for them. Also, why? Taken earlier this month from a Dr. Rewa Dhiyanandhan, in an interview he states the need for health surveillance not exclusively as an act of altruism, but additionally as an investment in self-preservation. Certainly, we can agree that identifying and containing infectious disease is of common human interest. However, we need to distinguish the difference between disease importance and disease urgency. The failure to suppress infectious disease results in both a clash of moral and ethical responses to priority. To some, the loss of human life may be the greatest of all perils. versus, to others, the loss of society wealth or even societal function itself may be more valuable to certain entities. I'd like to say it really comes down to the stakeholder we're talking about, correct?
Precisely, and as you said, depending on your take of it. As for intervening into this problem, normally the first method to combat infectious disease is the vertical approach. If you haven't heard of this, this strategy is top-down and resource-intensive, usually incorporated in situations which pose immediate health threats.
Such as what's going on with Ebola right now in West Africa.
Exactly, right. Pandemics. Interventions are fueled by external funding and tend to be objective, measurable, which is of value to donors tied to investment. However, there's vulnerability to this approach, and that is the sudden implementation of modern services and facilities can be short-sighted and is definitely limited in its compatibility for other uses. Lucrative as well, vertical programs tend to outcompete the quality of care within the local market, which can weaken the human resources and clientele of existing healthcare infrastructure. Nevertheless, vertical programs are functional and service a tremendous need when in demand. There's also horizontal programs, and these are definitely much more sustainable and can produce long-term results. They run along a bottom-up mentality, which focuses on integrated primary care and preventative services for an entire population. Usually financed by the national health system, existing healthcare infrastructure is utilized to provide dependable service across multiple determinants of health and over the life course. With a wide repertoire, this approach is less vulnerable to shifting funding dynamics. However, criticisms of horizontal interventions include a vague mandate, slow-term results, which make evaluation less tangible for investors. Also, horizontal programs rely on the assumption that adequate facilities and human resources are already established.
So clearly, vertical and horizontal approaches are shown to be effective, although each with their drawbacks. Which would be the most effective, you would say? And from what I know about these intervention programs, I believe the incorporation of both, such as a hybrid approach possibly, are needed to achieve an effective and long-lasting reduction of parasite prevalence.
I completely agree. However, the horizontal approach must win on the long run. But as stated, what do you do when you don't have the necessary infrastructure in place? For that reason, and that reason alone, I recommend a global mandate to establish a basic level of health infrastructure in the most volatile of areas through a vertical program. At this point, horizontal programs could take over for sustainability. It's definitely easier said than done, but I believe the best approach to development is to grow slowly and uniformly as a nation, where policies and interventions can be vastly and homogeneously applied, appealing to practicality as well as cost-effectiveness. Unfortunately, the reality of the developing world is a dynamic combination of over- and underdevelopment within a given nation. The drawback of working with high ranges of disparity include the difficulty to establish sustainable horizontal investments in global public goods.
And I imagine the failure to do so can result in the costly dysfunction of both human resources and health infrastructure.
Of course, definitely.
On the same subject, a program I recently heard about was the Chinese barefoot doctors. This has since stopped, but these people were farmers who received a small amount of medical or first aid training to treat people in rural regions. And I think it would be interesting to see the reoccurrence of this innovative technique and its effects, especially as we highlighted geographic inconsistencies in national development.
Yes, and I find that's an excellent historical example of the success of a minimalistic horizontal approach at the community level. It indeed would be interesting to see the implementation of such a strategy in other impoverished regions which lack a basic standard of primary care. It would alleviate many costs, I believe.
Right. One thing you always need to consider is funding. Who is investing in these interventions?
Well, there are a lot of institutions out there, like the Global Bank, the IMF, that would invest large amounts of money into global health issues, usually for a vertical approach. But the problem with this is that These institutions usually have their own agenda, a my money, my choice mentality, which severely limits what you can actually do with their funds. And also, secondly, they usually, this isn't negative in essence, but in this situation it could be. They usually invest into regions where poverty reigns. What I mean by that is in regions where there's a lot of poverty. But would the effect of infectious disease and IQ be high on their priority list? I'm not too sure.
All right, so closing up here, in respect to some of the conclusions of the study, average IQ had a significant negative correlation with winter high temperature, which had R values in 0.7 range, and winter low temperatures, versus insignificant associations with summer high temperatures, which had negligible R values, and summer low temperatures. This is to say, excuse my terminology, to break it down, the colder a nation is, the more intelligent it was. Cited from the article, a take on Darwinian selective pressures for intelligence stated, low or cold temperatures provide more fitness-related problems for humans that must be solved through cognitively demanding needs. So I'd like to ask, how will this relationship fare in the future under the effects of climate change? With a warming global climate, will northern developed nations see an increasing prevalence of infectious disease? More so, will IQ burden continue to increase in the already heavily plagued tropical regions of the world? In fact, I recently read a study from the International Agency 2012 where 35% of worldwide carbon dioxide emissions come from the BRIC nations, China alone contributing to 24% of this. Earlier, we point that development is the answer to increasing IQ, but is this development really sustainable in the long run?
You raise a good point there, and just last month, actually, the UN met and devised a plan so that many countries would reduce gas emission, stop deforestation, and finally act on climate control. According to BBC reporters covering the event, China would aim to reduce its emissions by 45% by 2020 compared to those they had in 2005.
Fair enough, but with all goals, I guess the only thing you can say is that time will tell whether they can actually be met.
Of course.
Worth mentioning is the summit held in 2000 regarding the implementations of the Millennium Development Goals. And while great and altruistic in their nature, are the targets adequately attainable in their projected time frame? Something to think about. Also, consider drug resistance. Is development truly the solution to parasite eradication? The CDC 2014 reports that each year in the United States, at least 2 million people become infected by drug-resistant bacteria, and of these people, 23,000 of them die. So I'd like to ask once again, what happens when advanced infectious agents enter contemporary life that science is not able to deal with? There's an excellent quote from the article I wanted to bring up. Data does not currently exist on the temporal variation of infectious disease severity across the world human history. Think about that for a second. Our entire conversation today is centered around the last 100 years or so of recordable history, but what is to say for our past or even for the future? I believe the parasite hypothesis should be regarded only a theory at best, and surely strategies for development can try to create a homogeneous distribution of worldwide cognition, but will it ever be an intelligent safe haven? A place where no threats of infectious disease exist? My name is Stefan, and this is The Tonight Show. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next time. La noche se aleja ya. Empieza a salir el sol. Las gaviotas vienen de lejos, cruzando mares, buscando amor. También con el corazón, cansado de navegar. Llegué a estas playas tibias y claras y anclé mis ansias para soñar. Vine el
decepcioné por un amor que me traicionó. Y fue tu puerto una esperanza en el naufragio.